Good morning. This is the KBOO Morning News for Monday, May 22nd, 2006. I'm LaToya Hudson.
And I'm Jake Wallner.
Coming up on the news, families of Kentucky miners killed in an explosion react to news that some of them died of carbon monoxide poisoning. Australia's Prime Minister faces criticism in his country for neglecting the issues of climate change. And a report from yesterday's Trojan implosion. Today's Portland's area weather. Showers likely in the mid-morning, then a chance of showers in the afternoon. High 65 to 70. Tonight, showers likely in the evening, then rain likely after midnight. Lows in the lower 50s.
Demolition crews destroyed the 499-foot cooling tower at the decommissioned Trojan nuclear power plant yesterday. It took almost 2,800 pounds of dynamite and only a few seconds to bring it down. KBOO's Rabia Yemin was there and filed this report.
Trojan nuclear power plant's cooling tower came down in a dramatic cloud of dust Sunday morning. I traveled to Kalama to see the first implosion of a nuclear cooling tower in the United States. I spoke with those who came to witness the destruction of Trojan's cooling tower. What follows are their reactions.
I've always had an interest in seeing what would happen with this reactor and the cooling tower and everything after it was shut down. And I'm actually a little bit disappointed that they aren't keeping it up as a monument.
I just think it's an exciting event, and I'm just here to see a historic event happen.
Well, I was involved in trying to stop the Whoops nuclear plants, and in so doing, back in the late 70s and early 80s, got to be good friends with the folks who were fighting Trojan. But then I was one of the consultants to PGE in the study that led to their decision to not fix the plant and to abandon it in 1992.
Longtime anti-nuclear activist Greg Cafori.
The most important thing out of this event is that people understand that this is a plant that was brought down by human beings. Organized people killed an operating nuclear plant against incredible odds, extraordinarily powerful forces. Politically, economically, this thing was a colossus, and it was a menace, and we killed it. And that's a message people need to know.
PGE spokesperson Scott Sims explains what onlookers can expect to see during the tower's implosion.
It's going to be starting at about 7 o'clock this morning. They'll be essentially imploding the Trojan tower and the cooling tower. It's been a long time in the making. We've been laying the plans now for more than a year. And the last few months, it's been a pretty intense amount of work as we've gotten the final stages done here.
Can you describe exactly what will occur during the implosion?
Yeah, during the implosion, there are a series of explosives placed in strategic locations on the tower that will allow it to essentially destabilize the tower and fall in on itself, using gravity really to bring the tower down. And so the tower is going to fall roughly in its footprint. It would almost be like if you could visualize it as a Coke can being stomped on by your foot, it would roughly be falling in on itself. And so that's really the role of the explosives, is just to help gravity.
Stay tuned all week for KBOO's in-depth news coverage on the history, activism, and ultimately the shutdown of the Trojan nuclear power plant. This is Rabia Yemin for KBOO News.
In Kentucky, relatives of coal miners killed in an explosion reacted angrily to an autopsy finding indicating that three of the five killed died of carbon monoxide poisoning. According to the Harlan County Coroner, the three men likely survived the initial blast, but then died of carbon monoxide poisoning. He said the other two died from multiple blunt force trauma and head injuries. Many family members recalled the Sago mine disaster in West Virginia, where carbon monoxide slowly asphyxiated 11 miners. Questions have since been raised about whether the Sago miners' air packs functioned properly. Officials were investigating whether the breathing devices used by the miners were working properly. A U.S. Senate panel last week approved a bill that would require miners to have at least 2 hours of oxygen available instead of one as required under the current policy. It also would require miner operators to store extra oxygen pack along escape routes. The national death toll from coal mining accidents this year is 31, with 10 of them in Kentucky.
Former U.S. Vice President Al Gore is warning that the world is facing a planetary emergency due to global warming. Gore spoke at the Cannes Film Festival, where a documentary based on his environmental campaigning is being screened. Gore said the world faced a stark choice between the end of civilization and a future for its children. He also said he was not considering running again for presidential office in 2008. The documentary, An Inconvenient Truth, is based on lectures Al Gore has been delivering about environmental crisis for many years. The film shows photographs of changes to glaciers around the world, with snow disappearing from the Alps, Antarctica, and the South Pole. Gore, who is donating his proceeds from the film towards a new environmental charity, said, "There were some powerful polluting interests that have way too much influence in the American political system."
In New Orleans yesterday, newly re-elected Mayor Ray Nagin expressed confidence that political opponents and business leaders would unite to rebuild the city. The day after he defeated Lieutenant Governor Mitch Landrieu, Nagin said he plans to put together a commission to decide on action in the next 100 days. Debris removal and housing will be top priorities. Nagin dismissed threats by some business people who supported Landrieu and said they would leave if Nagin remained in office. Nagin said, "Business people are predators, and if the economic opportunities are here, they're going to stay. If not, they're going to leave."
A congressman under investigation for bribery was caught on videotape accepting $100,000 in $100 bills from an FBI informant. The conversations with the lawmakers also were recorded, according to a court document released yesterday. Agents later found the cash hidden in his freezer. Representative William Jefferson, a Democrat from Louisiana, chuckles about writing in code to keep secret what the government contends was his corrupt role in getting his children a cut of a communications company deal for work in Africa. Jefferson, who represents New Orleans, has not been charged and denies any wrongdoing. The government says Jefferson got the money in a leather briefcase last July 30th at the Ritz-Carlton Hotel in Arlington. The plan was for the lawmaker to use the cash to bribe a high-ranking Nigerian official, the name is blacked out in the court document, to ensure the success of a business deal in that country.
The United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues have begun a 12-day meeting in New York in the hopes of addressing the economic marginalization, political repression, and mass displacement faced by many of the 370 million indigenous people living around the world. Today, FSRN brings you the voice of Western Shoshone grandmother Carrie Don, who used the occasion to speak out about the Defense Threat Reduction Agency's plan to experimentally trigger a massive explosion to simulate the effects of a bunker-busting nuclear bomb. The project is called Divine Strike.
I don't know why they call it divine. It's certainly when you're out to destroy things, it's not divine as far as I'm concerned. There's nothing holy about what they're planning on doing. This was scheduled for June 2nd, and from what I'm hearing now, that they have postponed it until June the 23rd. And so it's still in the plans of being detonated on Western Shoshone land. It's in Nevada, down at the nuclear test site, and I think that's a very bad idea because nobody knows what's going to happen. It might destroy the water underneath the water table underneath, because it's supposed to be something like a bunker buster. It's supposed to go down instead of, going up. And so we don't know what's going to happen to the water table, and we don't know whether it's going to contaminate anything. But we do have a real strong belief that it will disturb the radiation that's already on that land, and certainly that's not good for anybody.
That was Carrie Don's voice, recorded by FSRN's Rebecca Miles. The Year in Forum on Indigenous Issues continues next week.
Jurors resumed deliberations today in the federal fraud and conspiracy trial of Enron founder Kenneth Lay and former chief executive Jeffrey Skilling. The panel of 8 women and 4 men began a second full day of talks after receiving the case on Wednesday and putting in about 9.5 hours over a day and a half. Lay is also on trial separately without a jury on charges stemming from his personal banking. Skilling faces 28 counts of fraud, conspiracy, insider trading, and lying to auditors, and a maximum of 275 years in prison if convicted on all accounts. Lay faces 6 counts of fraud and conspiracy with a combined maximum punishment of 45 years. Both are accused of repeatedly lying when they told investors and employees Enron was robust when they knew it was propped up by accounting tricks that hid losses and flailing ventures. The two men say their optimism was genuine and attribute Enron's failure to bad publicity and lost market confidence.
A roadside bomb exploded outside a health clinic in Shiite neighborhoods southwest of Baghdad today. It killed 3 civilians and injured up to 9 just hours before Iraq's parliament was to address ways to combat sectarian violence. Another bomb barely missed a police patrol in eastern Baghdad and injured 2 others. The violence occurred as British Prime Minister Tony Blair arrived in Baghdad. Shortly after Iraq's first cabinet meeting, a suicide bomber killed at least 13 people and wounded 17 by blowing himself up in a busy Baghdad restaurant, popular with police officers. 3 of the dead were policemen.
Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez said yesterday that he believes journalists can be prosecuted for publishing classified information. The nation's top law enforcer also said the government will not hesitate to track telephone calls made by reporters as part of a criminal leak investigation, but officials would not do so routinely and randomly. Gonzalez said, "We have an obligation to ensure that our national security is protected." In recent months, journalists have been called into court to testify as part of investigations into leaks, including the unauthorized disclosure of a CIA operative's name, as well as the National Security Agency's warrantless eavesdropping program. Gonzalez said he would not comment specifically on whether the New York Times should be prosecuted for disclosing the NSA program last year based on classified information. He also denied that authorities would randomly check journalists' records on domestic-to-domestic phone calls in an effort to find journalists' confidential sources.
U.S. Army Sergeant Santos Cardona is accused of abusing 2 detainees at Abu Ghraib prison by threatening them with a dog he was in charge while they were being interrogated. An Army general has also been ordered to testify about U.S. interrogations and detention policies. Cardona's attorney have been allowed to call Major General Jeffrey Miller to court to question him about the use of dogs in security interrogation operations in U.S. jails in Iraq and at Guantanamo Bay. He is the highest-ranking officer to ever take the stand in any of the prosecutions arising from the abuse at Abu Ghraib. Cardona's lawyers say they will press the general for information about a trip he made to Iraq to advise U.S. officials on how to get better intelligence from detainees. They claim that shortly after his trip, military dogs were shipped to Abu Ghraib and approved for use in interrogations. The prosecution, however, says there is no evidence to suggest that orders came to use dogs in this way. If convicted, Cardona could face up to 16 years in jail. This from BBC News.
A Kuwait criminal court yesterday acquitted 5 former Guantanamo detainees of charges that they collected money for Osama bin Laden's Al-Qaeda network. The 5 were freed from the U.S. prison at Guantanamo Bay in November, but were arrested upon their return home to Kuwait and were charged with belonging to Al-Qaeda. The lawyers for the men argued that there was no evidence to convict them and that Kuwaiti courts had no jurisdiction to try them because they had not done anything illegal in Kuwait. Defense attorneys also told the tribunal that testimonies collected at Guantanamo Bay and provided by the United States could not be used in a Kuwaiti court because they did not have the signatures of the detainees or interrogators. The defendants were charged with collecting money through Al-Wafa, an Afghan charity the U.S. military says helped finance Al-Qaeda. They were also accused of fighting alongside Afghanistan's ousted Taliban regime.
Officials say 15 civilians were wounded in the airstrikes. Other reports say 30 civilians were killed and 50 injured. Coalition warplanes are said to have dropped bombs on an Islamic religious school and homes in which Taliban fighters had taken up position. Eyewitness and local doctors say children are among those injured. There has been a dramatic upsurge in fighting in southern Afghanistan over the past week. Officials estimate up to 200 rebels have been killed in the region since last Wednesday, in some of the fiercest fighting since the fall of the Taliban in late 2001. The U.S.-led coalition in Afghanistan said it was looking into the reports of civilian deaths. This from the BBC News.
Australia's Prime Minister John Howard visited North America last week. His close ally George W. Bush wined and dined Howard, and Howard also met with his Canadian counterpart to discuss the Asia-Pacific Environment Partnership, a breakaway group designed to undermine the International Kyoto Protocol. Meanwhile, back in Australia, Howard's critics are attacking the latest federal government budget for neglecting the issue of climate change. FSRN's Erica Vowles has this report.
The latest Australian budget was the biggest spend up in years, delivering tax cuts worth 36.7 billion Australian dollars over 4 years to wealthy and low-income Australians. But aside from a large injection of funds for the beleaguered river system, the Murray-Darling, the environment was largely overlooked. Not only were the words climate change not mentioned once, but now it seems that the department responsible for climate forecasting may be the only government department to actually face staff cuts. Labor Shadow Environment Minister Anthony Albanese.
What's extraordinary is that the budget papers show that the only department which will have staff losses in the next 12 months is the Department of Environment and Heritage, 37 directly, but another 13 for the Bureau of Meteorology, which is a part of the Department of Environment and Heritage. Of particularly concern is that the 13 staff long-range climate forecasters and the 37 staff, we know from information we've been able to get that those staff will be cut from the climate science and climate community education programs.
In stark contrast to the Conservative coalition federal government currently in power, the Labor Party has promised that if it wins office at the next election, it will sign the Kyoto Protocol, implement an emissions trading scheme, as well as support renewable energy.
We really need to get serious now about preparing Australia for a carbon-constrained economy. And the great concern is that the longer we delay the inevitable transition that will be necessary, the higher the cost will be when Australia comes to terms with that and has a government that's prepared to address these issues.
But is all this going to be enough? While the Federal Greens maintain that Federal Labor's changes are welcome, their spokesperson on climate change, Senator Christine Milne, says more needs to be done to stop Australia's reliance on fossil fuel-based energy.
We need a national energy efficiency target, mandatory fuel vehicle efficiency standards. There are so many things we could be doing, but unfortunately neither the Liberal or Labor Party want to go far enough, and the fact that both of them are going to support these massive tax cuts for high-income earners suggests that they would prefer to put that money in the pockets of middle Australia as a vote-buying exercise for the federal election next year.
A number of major corporations recently came together under the banner of the Australian Business Roundtable on Climate Change, claiming that early action on cutting greenhouse gases would not impact on Australia's productivity, while delaying the conversion to a renewable energy economy would have drastic long-term implications. However, other powerful business groups are operating in Canberra, and they're having a major impact on policy formation wherever it threatens the fossil fuel industry. Dr. Clive Hamilton, the chair of the Climate Institute, says the ability of these lobby groups to impact on government policy puts in doubt Australia's democracy.
There is operating in Canberra what is known as the Greenhouse Mafia, and who not only have a great influence over the federal government, but who have admitted to actually writing government policy on energy and climate change. So this is more than just a debate over energy and climate policy. This is actually a serious issue about the nature of the democratic process in Australia, where we see the government responding not to popular concerns about climate change, but to the financial self-interest of a very small and powerful group of companies and lobbyists.
The Federal Minister for the Environment and his department were contacted by FSRN but declined to comment. This is Erica Voles in Sydney reporting for Free Speech Radio News.
Montenegro has voted to secede from Serbia and form a separate nation. With nearly all ballots from Sunday's referendum counted, over 55% of voters choose independence. That's just over the threshold needed for the referendum to be valid under the rules set by the European Union. The pro-independence Prime Minister Milo Djukanovic said the citizens of Montenegro voted to restore their statehood. Many in Montenegro hope to retain their ethnic identity, which they believe to be distinct from that of Serbia.
Tunisia has expelled a Swiss member of the rights group Amnesty International. Amnesty International in Tunisia said Yves Steiner was arrested yesterday while attending an annual meeting of the organization's Tunisian branch. A Tunisian official said Steiner was invited to leave after violating the law and attacking public order. Tunisia has often been accused of harassing human rights activists and suppressing independent media, allegations the government denies. Steiner was released from police custody later and flew to France. A Swiss-based Amnesty spokesperson said he has not been able to talk to Steiner and does not know why he was expelled. This from the BBC News.
The Supreme Court today refused to consider the case of a convicted murderer who graduated from law school and is being thwarted in his efforts to become a practicing attorney in Arizona. James Hom served 17 years in prison after pleading guilty to the murdering a man in a drug-related robbery. Both victims in the 1974 shootings were unarmed. Last year, the Arizona Supreme Court denied Hom's application to practice law, saying he had failed to establish the good moral character necessary to be admitted. Supporters in his application included a letter from the judge who sentenced him for murder, from several practicing attorneys in the good standing, and from the president of the Arizona Psychological Association. The Arizona Supreme Court found that Hom was not completely forthright regarding the murders because he said he did not intend to kill, but only to rob his victims. The Arizona Supreme Court said he shot one victim twice to make sure he was dead and shot the second victim to prevent his escape. Hom earned a degree in sociology from Northern Arizona University through a prison program. After his sentence was commuted, he attended Arizona State University's law school and passed the bar exam in 1999.
That's the KBOO Morning News for Monday, May 22nd, 2006. Portland area weather for today, showers in the morning, then a chance of showers in the afternoon, high 65 to 70. Tonight, showers likely in the evening, then rain, 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 and more rain. You are listening to KBOO at 90.7 FM in Portland, in Corvallis at 100.7 FM on transmitter K2648A, and in Hood River at 91.9 FM. translator K220HR. You can log on to our website at kboo.fm. Our producer for this morning's newscast is Kathleen Stevenson. Our engineer is Matt Bingley. I'm Jake Wallner.
And I'm LaToya Hudson.
Stay tuned for a wonderful day of programming coming up.